Wars Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Essen, and I'm joined by Chief Political Correspondent and Head Debbie Downer, Andrew Riley. Andrew, it is April 29th, Wednesday, and it's happening! Cue the Ron Paul GIF. I don't know if anybody else is going to get that reference, but I'm totally doing the jazz hands, and I'm imagining the seizure-inducing flashing colors behind me. Justin Amash has officially announced he's running for the Libertarian nomination for president. What are your thoughts?
He's running for the Libertarian nomination for president. He is trying to get nominated for a party that, in its best showing in a very long time, won between 2 and 3% of the popular vote last election, has won an electoral vote only in the case when there was a faithless elector, has never had a major showing on a national election, has a few elected officials in small offices throughout the country.
Hey, they have a U.S. congressman still, now.
It's still the largest third party in the country. So, I mean, it's not a big deal in its own way, but it's not something to be excited about.
Hey, they might. Well, so last election, they had ballot access in all 50 states.
Yes.
Going to be considerably harder this election collecting those signatures in this social distancing time frame, especially with hostile state legislatures and judiciaries. But, you know, so I'm going to do some fact checking here. 3.28% of the popular vote last election. That's good for almost 4.5 million votes. That's not a bad showing. And we had two historically unlikable candidates in Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I'm going to argue that we have, in their own way, almost as equally unlikable candidates, or maybe not unlikable, because you can say a lot of things about Joe Biden. I think unlikable is probably not top five, but possibly senile and unfit
he's
for
not
office.
A strong candidate. Let's put it that way, right?
He's an awful candidate. He's like he was the George W. Bush. We've gone over this for a while. And we know everyone knows my opinion on Joe Biden, but he was the perennial goofball who couldn't stop making gaffes and clearly doesn't seem to be all there from anyone who's been watching any of his press conferences. He's in seclusion almost as much as Kim Jong-un right now, probably because of fear of coronavirus, because he's like 80 years old. I think... When you look at the age and the abrasiveness / senility of the two major party candidates, and you contrast it with the nonpartisan, principled, young, and generally non-abrasive Justin Amash, I think there's a chance for this to be the Libertarian Party's best showing ever.
Okay.
Convince me I'm wrong.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to convince you you're wrong, because this could very well be their best showing ever and still be totally meaningless. I am number
sure.
one that Justin Amash has going against him is, one, that you and I know who he is, because Justin Amash is a guy that we like. We followed his process in Congress. We've watched him get elected. We've liked a lot of the things he's done and stood for, because we are libertarians, libertarian-leaning. We like what he's doing. Justin Amash has zero name recognition outside of people like you and me, and our friends, because we talk about him.
I think he has one name recognition.
You
because he decided to break away from the Republican Party and was the only, well, he would have been the only Republican to have supported, in the House of Representatives, I guess I should say, to support the articles of impeachment against Donald Trump. I think he made a bit of a name for himself there. Obviously, yes, I think most of the... Gosh, this is going to be a dated reference, but the Jay Leno jaywalking where he shows pictures of people to random New Yorkers and they can't identify like the vice president or the Queen of England or whatever. Obviously, most people aren't going to be able to pick Justin Amash out of the lineup or have any idea who he is. But I think people who follow politics and are into politics, they follow the impeachment proceedings. And I think they're going to pick up his name from that. So I think... one out of whatever number whatever the scale is, he has name recognition of.
So I say he has zero, because zero matches every scale, and it's pretty close to what he's got at the very least. And you're saying he's got some level of name recognition, and okay, fine, he has some level of name recognition. What name recognition he has may not always be very good name recognition, because he's also been taking some unpopular stances, which we agree with, but may not be populist, shall we say, because he's a libertarian. He's not a populist. I think that could go a long way towards the people who do know who he is, maybe not already having all that fond of an opinion of him. The people who were paying very close attention to the impeachment proceedings, who got to hear about his name there, they probably had a vested interest in the impeachment proceedings, quite possibly because they're very staunch Democrats and will vote for the Democratic candidate, whomever it is, vote blue no matter who, or they are very staunch supporters of the president and were paying attention to see who would cast the votes against him. And that obviously is not helping Amash out there, because they're going to vote for the president. And even if they weren't, they're certainly not going to vote for Amash now.
Well, the way I see it is the Republican base, the people who are going to vote Trump no matter what, they weren't going to vote for Amash no matter what. So there's no loss there. On the flip side, the hardcore Democrats who think that you need to vote for Joe Biden to, the only thing that matters is getting Trump out of office and you got to vote for Biden no matter what, they weren't going to vote for a third party no matter what either. But there's an interesting middle ground of there's some never Trumpers in the Republican Party. I don't know if there's many of them left. It certainly doesn't seem like it based on the Republican primaries, what few have been happening. But there are still some people who don't like Trump. They should have little problem with Amash, I would think. Obviously, yes, he has some of his libertarian ideas are probably not the most gelling with their viewpoint of the world, but he's probably going to be better than the Green Party nominee or voting for Biden. And there's probably, I think there's a non-insignificant number of disaffected Bernie voters, people who want to upset the system, who feel betrayed by the Democratic Party and think that they won't vote for Biden. And, you know, maybe they'll go Green Party, who knows. But if they see this independent who would have supported impeachment against Trump, they might see him as the ultimate FU vote and decide to go for him too.
So if our threshold for success is best performance by a libertarian ever, I think you have a chance, like I said. I don't think it's going to happen, because the biggest threat that a libertarian candidate has ever had has been the voter who says, forget it, it's just not worth my time. That voting for anybody but the person who's going to win is throwing my vote away. And as I know, this is something that we're going to come back to in a second. But those people stay home. They don't make the effort to go out and vote. And people who don't make the effort to go out and vote, no matter who their preference is, aren't counted. So there may be people who end up sitting at home in November or not mailing in a ballot in November, who could be the votes who might have been able to push Amash into a strong position, but I suspect in the long run will not vote for Amash and likely not vote for anyone. This election, just like every election for the past, I don't know, decades of elections, will be decided by those people who do not go to the polls.
This might be similar to what you're saying, but I have a slightly different take. I think that the 2016 election was in some ways a story of apathy, in that people disliked Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump so much that turnout was depressed, and that in some ways helped the libertarian candidates, because they got a lot of the people who are like, ugh, these guys both suck, and whatever, I'm just going to vote for the Libertarian Party candidate. I suspect that the turnout for this election will be much higher, because as opposed to apathy, there is a lightning rod in Donald Trump, the president, and a lot of people have very strong opinions on him, whether it's we have to vote him back in office because MAGA and gotta defeat fake news and, you know, can't let this be stolen from us, or the restore the soul of America, Biden. We got to do whatever we can do to kick this blundering idiot and fascist out of office before he becomes king of America. And if you look at, I know you're not on Twitter, but if you look at Justin Amash announced on Twitter that he was running for president, and easily like 80% of the first 100 or so comments in response were all like, you know, F you, tool of Putin, please don't do this, wait until 2024, you're just going to hand the election to Trump, you know, why are you stealing voters from Biden, all the arguments that we've both heard over the years, the decades. And I get the feeling, and I've seen the same thing with Howard Schultz when he dared to suggest that he might run for president as an independent and not in the Democratic primary. He got absolutely crushed. And so I suspect what worries me is that there's just going to be this, more so than almost any time in our lifetimes, at least in presidential elections, there's going to be a, you have to vote either for Trump or against Trump. And maybe Amash can get the numbers in terms of, maybe he'll get the highest pure number of votes, but I think the percentage might be depressed because of that, because you're going to get so many people out there who want to pull the lever as a referendum on Trump, either for or against.
Let's put a pin on the percentage of the turnout, because I think that might be something interesting to come back to a little bit later on. But I want to spend a few seconds talking and expounding further on your ideas there about wasting the votes and voting against the candidates. The vast, vast majority of people who vote in the presidential election are not voting for a candidate. They're voting against the candidate of the other party. If I vote in 2020 for Donald Trump, it's not because I like Donald Trump. I really don't like Donald Trump. It's because I'm voting against Joe Biden, right?
Sure. I think a stronger argument can be for Biden, but sure, I understand what you're saying.
Many people on the left have already talked about this, where it's going to vote blue no matter who, because they can't stand Trump, and it doesn't matter who the Democratic Party. So there's obviously more of them over there than there is just the one of me. But I'm another example of that, that if I go into that situation, into the poll booth, and those are my choices, you put the gun to my head, I got to choose one of these two, because these are the only two that have a chance of winning. Again, we'll come back to that, I think. I can't vote for Biden. It cannot happen. I wrote an article that says Joe Biden cannot be allowed to be president of the United States. Clearly, I cannot vote for him. I will vote for Trump over Biden. And I hate myself for saying that, for thinking that, for even admitting it. But it's not going to happen. Biden will never get my vote. Trump could, not very likely, because I have third-party options. I will happily vote for Justin Amash. I don't think he's perfect, but he's miles better than these two idiots. So I'm excited. I'm excited just alongside you. I just don't think he has any chance to win, and I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with voting for somebody who has no chance to win, because I'm voting for someone. If everyone voted for someone, we'd have a completely different election.
That's me clapping and accidentally hitting the microphone at the same time. So that's probably not going to work very well in an audio podcast. But yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I have, as you know, many thoughts on those people who angrily say, like, you cannot throw your vote away, and a vote for Amash is a vote for Trump, and all those other things. And I'm not
certainly not in my case. A vote for Amash could very well be taking a vote away from Trump.
I mean, the difference to me is that, like, I cannot imagine myself voting for either Biden or Trump. I'm definitely one of those people who are like, I'm going to vote for somebody else no matter what. It's going to be a write-in. It's going to be a third party. It's going to be staying home. Like, I can't imagine a situation where you could force me. You'd have to take my family hostage and the literal gun to the head in order to have me vote for one of the two of them. And so it's silly to say that a vote for Amash is a vote for X, because it has no meaning to me. And I think that's true for a lot of people. I think there's a lot of people out there who are going to write in candidates, who are going to vote for Bernie or write in Bernie or vote for Jill Stein or whatever it is. And I also think that there's a good chance he's going to pull from both parties. Like, it's crazy to me that people have these ideas that, and it comes from both sides. It's going to throw the election to Trump. It's going to throw the election to Biden. We don't know. The numbers usually show that it's kind of a toss-up. Maybe it's like a third disaffected voters, a third Republicans, a third Democrats. Who knows? But I also don't even care, because my vote doesn't belong to anybody. You know? Like, I just because Biden is the major party candidate to go up against Trump, it doesn't mean that I have to vote for him if I want Trump out of office. No, I can vote for somebody. Every single election of my lifetime, I have been told by multiple people that this is the most important election. And this, you cannot throw away your vote this election. Wait until next election. You have to vote for the lesser of two evils this election. And pretty much every single election, the candidates have been getting worse and worse and worse. I didn't think that was possible last election. And it may not be possible this. It may not be the case this election. Hillary Clinton was a special kind of bad. That Biden is just a different kind of bad. But it makes no sense to me that I have to, that someone would tell me that I have to vote for somebody who doesn't represent, who maybe matches my viewpoints 20, 30% at best, so that I can prevent someone who matches my viewpoints 10, 15% maybe from taking office, when there's somebody out there who, you said he's not perfect. I'm interested in coming back to that, because I'm wondering how he's not perfect to you. But he's probably a 90, 95% match for my viewpoints. Like, why not vote for that? Why not vote for somebody as opposed to just voting against the guy who is just slightly worse than the other person?
So let's talk about the Libertarian Party for a second. You were wearing tonight the Gary Johnson for President t-shirt.
Yeah, I told you ahead of time. I thought about having my Don't Tread on Me flag in the background. I had to choose between my Gary Johnson t-shirt, my Ron Paul t-shirt, my Robert Sarvis t-shirt. So that's a deep cut for Virginia voters. He was the gubernatorial candidate a couple elections back. But I had a lot of visual aids I was going to use, and then I realized it's an audio podcast, so I didn't go there.
Right. But the thing about Gary Johnson is that he got those fairly significant percentage of votes, not because he was an amazing candidate, but as you were saying, because Clinton and Trump were remarkably bad candidates. Gary Johnson couldn't remember and had no idea where Aleppo was, right?
Or what is Aleppo?
Exactly. So this is a critical failure for a man running for president in the middle of a period of time when we are engaged in military kinetic action in Syria, right?
Although, having said that, I do believe very strongly that gaffe was absolutely dwarfed by almost anything Trump said in terms of foreign policy.
Or Joe Biden.
And frankly, by a lot of things that Hillary Clinton either said or her record as Secretary of State.
Sure.
Like, I won't go any further than that. But like, Hillary Clinton has a horrible record as Secretary of State. And just because you momentarily blank out on in terms of I'll stop.
Right. So let me expand on this point a little bit. I have defended Gary Johnson on this point on many occasions because he's a presidential candidate at this point. He was a governor. A governor doesn't need to know about a city in Syria, even if he probably ought to, based on the fact that he's running for president. He was a candidate. He doesn't get the briefings from our intelligence about the goings-on. He's not involved in the war room situations. If he was, he would have known. He didn't have that, and his ignorance was excusable based on the position. The inexcusable part, and one of the reasons why he was a bad candidate, was that he didn't come back to that and say, I don't know where Aleppo was. Where's Aleppo? It doesn't matter. I'm talking about bread and butter issues for the American family. I'm talking about financial things. I'm talking about the domestic side of things. And when it comes to foreign policy, Aleppo isn't our biggest concern. We have China to deal with. We have these things to deal with. Points that he could have pulled from his policy, he didn't say any of that. He had a very lackluster response to that gaffe. Sometimes other candidates will have gaffes, and they may have a better response. But ultimately, he paid a lot for that gaffe, mostly because he was already so under the radar. But my point is that Amash is a much better candidate than Gary Johnson was. He is not someone that I agree with 100%, like I said, but I agree with him more than I did with Gary Johnson, and I will probably feel that way even if Amash makes a significant number of gaffes, because Johnson has enough problems as a candidate, as a politician in the past, even one who had some electoral success, that I did not feel as comfortable with him. I did vote for him. He was my choice for president in 2016, but largely because the other guys were even worse. And by a large margin.
It's sexist, guys and girls.
Guys and girls, sure. But they were terrible. And so Gary Johnson being less than perfect, you know, coming in at an 85%, he was a solid B. A solid B beats two Fs.
Yeah, no, I pretty much completely agree with you. Gary Johnson was a bad politician. And I don't necessarily mean that as an insult. In some ways, it's a compliment.
I think he's a decent guy.
Yeah, I actually think that he was one of the best guys to have run for president in a long time. He seemed like a really affable and good man. But any kind of skilled politician would have taken that question where you do not know what they're talking about and deflected or said, like, you know, Aleppo's not important. Let's talk about, to your point, let's talk about, you know, minimum wage or whatever, something that resonates more with Americans. And this is something that I should have brought up earlier. In addition to being, you know, younger and everything else, I've mentioned thinking that Joe Biden is senile, and Trump certainly has a more aggressive form of senility where he seems to be proud of his ignorance. Justin Amash is a pretty sharp and quick fellow. Like, I follow him on Twitter. He's good with, like, the kind of throwing out the quick comebacks and stuff like that. He's very knowledgeable. He's not going to get, you know, outboxed or whatever. I don't know, whatever the terminology would be. In fact, he should look really good in comparison to these guys. I know that it's always the hope and wish to get the Libertarian candidate on the debate stage, and I'm not going to say that there's any chance of that happening this time around. But if that were to ever happen, I would have to. And obviously, we all come into this with our different biases, and three people can watch the same debate and think three different people won. But I think it would be very obvious the difference in terms of just the mental faculties between Justin Amash and the two major party candidates. And I think that would be hard to ignore, even for a hardcore partisan.
Yeah, I think that if he got on the debate stage, it would do him a ton of good, and probably do him more good than any Libertarian candidate since Harry Brown.
Yeah. I was actually, when there was a lot of talk about getting Gary Johnson on the debate stage, I was actually worried about that because of his difficulty in public speaking and
not his strong suit.
General goofiness. Yeah, he was, I mean, Ron Paul had his own faults and was not, he was kind of a quirky debater. He made it work somehow, but
he had charisma. Gary Johnson does not have charisma.
I don't even know if I'd say Ron Paul had charisma, but he had an appeal to certain people that worked despite himself, I think. And Gary Johnson just did not have that. Like, he just seemed like a complete goofball on stage, which, again, I loved the guy. I think he was a great, great guy, but just an awful speaker and politician. So, but Justin Amash, man, I would be praying, if I was a religious person, I'd be praying every single day that he would be able to get on the debate stage, because I think he would just make a complete mincemeat out of the other two candidates.
But he's not going to make it on the debate stage, which gets me to one of my questions about this. He has, as I said, zero name recognition. How is he going to get it? Because he's not going to be invited to the debates. He's facing hostile legislature. He's facing a hostile media. What can he possibly do to actually get his name out there so that he gets to the point where people would actually vote for him?
Well, as I said before, I believe he has one name recognition, not zero. But more seriously, let's try and quantify it a little bit. Who would you say is do you think he has a similar amount of name recognition to a Pete Buttigieg?
No, absolutely not.
To a Amy Klobuchar?
Nope, senator. She still beats him.
Okay. How about to Bill de Blasio?
Big name mayor, big city versus congressman.
I would say probably still loses because of coronavirus and his name being in it now.
Current de Blasio wins because he was also a candidate for president and he's made a big stink, especially recently. My goodness, can you possibly be stupider than telling people in New York that Jews shouldn't gather?
Well, we'll find out. I'm sure next week he'll be trying to top that.
Yeah, so I think right now he's got it, and I think that probably was the case even beforehand, but that's closer. So big city mayor versus congressman, it's tough. He has, I'd say, even among congressmen, he has a lower name recognition than I'd say half of the congressmen.
Oh, wow. No, see, I disagree with that. Can you name like five congressmen that you think have a higher name recognition than him? I mean, there's obviously the Speaker of the House and whatnot, but...
So Nancy Pelosi is top of the list. And then you're going to get to people talking about former congressmen. So that's part of the problem. You know, Ryan and whatnot. So you can start going down that list. And those people probably don't count because they're not current congressmen. But he certainly has much lower name recognition than any of them.
Okay, maybe, yeah.
And then there's your own congressman, who you presumably know the name of, although I, of course, understand that many people do not. But if they don't know their own congressman, they're not going to know Amash either. So
I know this is a really poor proxy, but I wonder if we looked at Twitter followers or Facebook followers or something like that, I wouldn't at all be surprised if Amash was, gosh, how many? There's 435 congressmen. Mm-hmm. Is that, remember right?
Yep.
I wouldn't be surprised if he was top 20.
Twitter? So. Yeah. I'd certainly say top 20 above those, and maybe even top 10.
I mean, libertarians, as much as they punch below their weight in elections, they do, because there's so few of quote-unquote us, like, that are prominent politicians, when there's a Ron Paul or a Justin Amash, they get a lot of attention.
Right. Ron Paul was a representative from Texas, but he may as well have been my representative for the amount of time I paid to his attention. I could theoretically have written to him, and he wouldn't have done anything for me because I'm not his constituent. But writing to my own congressperson doesn't do me any good either. So, no, I've definitely followed Amash more because I agree with his positions more than my own congressperson, who I disagree with on pretty much everything. So,
here's maybe a better comparison. At this point in time, so we're talking 7 months before the election, who do you think had more name recognition nationwide? Justin Amash now or Gary Johnson in April of 2016?
That's a fair question.
He was at that point.
Ex-governor.
He was ex-governor of New Mexico, not exactly the biggest state in the world. And I guess he had run previously for, I had that right? He had two consecutive presidential elections he ran for.
Yes.
President. So, but again, like, who pays attention to the Libertarian Party candidate besides us?
Right. So, overall, I think Gary Johnson probably had more name recognition. Even being a governor from a small state is one of 50 versus being a congressman who is one of, he's in a state with 10 or 11 other congressmen. So,
even so you're not giving him any credit for like the splash he made during the impeachment hearings.
I'm going to give him almost zero credit for that because it doesn't matter. Because the people who saw that and paid attention to that are never going to be his voters.
They're on the far extremes anyway.
Yeah, the people who are looking and finally found out who he was because of that, they either are, you know, like, yay, he's one of us. Why, if you're going to defect from the Republican Party, why not just become a Democrat? Or you're a traitor to the Republicans. I'm glad you're out of the party because you were just a rhino anyway. Hmm.
Do you, perhaps more importantly than his current name recognition, what do you think the media response is going to be?
Because they're going to do exactly what they always do. They're going to ignore it.
Well, so I'll say that, so I agree with you in general, but I think in 2016, the media was more fair than they often are in terms of the coverage they provided for Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. I think CNN had a couple of like town halls. I think they were looking more so than usual to make a third party candidate a thing because of how poorly they saw the major party candidates shaping up.
I think the major party, the Democrats, sorry, let me try this again. I think the media was so confident in Hillary Clinton's victory that they were willing to entertain a third party candidate more, because it made the election more interesting. It was something to talk about other than, hey, she's going to win.
But now they're desperate and they just are going to try and squash any non-Biden candidate?
I mean, I don't want to say that I think the media are partisan hacks, because I think there's a lot of good media out there, and I don't think they all intend to do that. But I do think that that will be close to what the effect will be. The media will be very, very pro-Biden. And in fact, they already have been. And this is something that we were going to come to anyway, so this might be a fair transition point.
Go for it.
The media has been remarkably reticent to dig into the Tara Reid situation. Tara Reid has accused Joe Biden of sexual assault and misconduct when she was working on his campaigns in the past. And the New York Times investigated it and essentially dismissed it. Whereas similar claims against other politicians of a similar stature, with frankly far less evidence, were dragged out, extended, investigated with much deeper effort, and brought out in published in much more limelight than this accusation has been, in part because it's a done deal, right? Biden is the de facto Democratic nominee. So if they take him down, then Trump is highly likely to win re-election. And I don't think that's anything that they want to be a part of.
So, honest question. I'm not trying to approach this from a position of... So full disclosure, obviously I am approaching this from a position of the media is doing a bit of a disservice here, but I'm totally open to my mind being changed. I look at the situation with Kavanaugh, a year or two ago, they're in the Supreme Court.
It's got to be confirmation almost hearings. 2 years ago. It's been a while.
Two years ago. And how there was a single credible accusation that was made that could not be corroborated by anybody. And in fact, I think her own parents didn't even necessarily, Christine Blasey Ford, her own parents, I think, were on record as not necessarily having believed the allegations. And there couldn't be nobody could find any evidence that she had told anybody else up until I don't mean this in an attacking way, but the convenient timing of, oh, he's about to be elected to the Supreme Court and the Democrats desperately want to stop him. And suddenly she remembers this attack. And I contrast that with this accusation, which seems just as credible as the previous one, but has corroboration that she told other people about it a long time ago. And it wasn't just Joe Biden's the nominee now, I'm going to come out from the shadows. But I guess her mom had called into
Larry King Live or something Live for looking for advice. What a crazy thing to do. That seems really weird to me. But
which seems weird, but at least it's one extra data point. And not only that, we know, like, for a fact that Joe Biden is creepy with women. Like,
Up to this, it's been he has no sense of boundaries rather than he's actually doing creepy, creepy stuff. This is full-on sexual assault he's being alleged to have done, which is a different level than we've heard him accused of before. So it's a different thing. But he has a history of doing stuff that has been seen as at least a little bit outside of the norms of that moment.
I completely agree. I'm just looking at it as there was basically a single non-corroborated data point with Kavanaugh. And that was enough to completely convince seemingly half the country that he was a rapist that should never be on the Supreme Court. And that's it. Judge, jury, executioner. Whereas with Biden, we have one corroborated, in a manner of speaking, data point, and a lot of other much lesser offenses that kind of point in the same direction of him being, just like not having not knowing the appropriate boundaries with women, taking inappropriate liberties perhaps with them. I don't know what the exact terminology to use, so I won't go any further there. But it seems like, in a objective sense, this should be a much huger deal, especially since most people consider president to be. I know we might think differently. Supreme Court justice.
Supreme Court is very, very important, especially because it's a lifetime appointment. But this is Joe Biden. His first 4 years in office could be his lifetime.
and most people I would say would consider president to be the most important position. So it's hard not to look at this and see just a tremendous partisan bias at play here. And I don't know how else to interpret it other than that. Can you convince me otherwise?
I can't. I am not going to be able to do that for a variety of reasons. One, because I agree too much with you. I think that there is a partisan
bias. This
is why we need Travis here, but I don't think that would help us out too much either in this particular case. There is a partisan bias on the part of certain journalists who may be the ones actually doing the investigation or being tasked with looking into this or being the ones who are the editors and making the decisions about what stories to run or not run. Those kinds of things, even though it doesn't represent perhaps the entirety of the news media or any individual journalistic enterprise, comes to a point where it can be harmful to the entirety of the media because those decisions made by a few individuals with their bias causes those kinds of outcomes. But when we look at the Kavanaugh situation being most recent in our minds, the differences between them are very, very stark. Kavanaugh, as you said, won solid accuser. But that solid accuser was from longer ago than Tara Reid is alleging her misconduct from Biden.
That's a good point.
And had the additional complicating factor of a substantial amount of intoxicants being in use during the encounter. So 10 extra years, an extra decade, plus memory loss or whatever, plus the alcohol use and a number of other factors make that case a harder one to sell. It's one of the reasons why when the chips were all in, people were saying, yeah, it could have happened, but we can't say for sure that it did, and we're not going to let an accusation stand in the way of a person's job on the line. Similarly, this is just an accusation from Tara Reid, but it is a stronger accusation in the court of law, but not necessarily in the court of public opinion. Because Christine Blasey Ford was a very strong witness. She got in front of the Senate, and she provided her testimony. It was emotional, and it was believable. For whatever reason, and I think, as unfair as it may be to say, attractiveness has a lot to do with this. Tara Reid is not being believed. She's not presenting herself in a way that people will say, oh yeah, this definitely happened to you. And that is putting too much weight on the victim. The victim, in any of these situations, should not have the burden of demonstrating that this has happened. The facts bear that burden. And people aren't listening to the facts. They're listening to emotions, and emotions play very heavily when people's personal words and emotions and inflections and personal appearances all come into play into that calculus as well.
That's a good point. I am unaware of what Tara Reid looks like, so it didn't even occur to me. That's how little, I guess, media attention this has gotten. I have a very clear picture of what Kavanaugh looks like, what Blasey Ford looks like. But I have no sense of what Tara Reid looks like Tara Reid. Isn't there an actress named Tara Reid? It just occurred to me.
I have no idea. You are really outside my wheelhouse right now.
Sorry. As I said Tara Reid, I'm like, I must have gotten that name wrong because I'm pretty sure Tara Reid is an actress from American Pie. Anyway, sorry. It is Tara Reid. I just checked my notes. I have no clue what she looks like. That's how little, I guess, she's been in the news. Maybe some of this is, I don't know. Has she been pushing this? I have no idea if she doesn't want this story to be told, or.
Tara? No, she's been pretty open about it recently.
Okay.
But yeah, when did this start? I mean, this call comes back again to when did she bring it up? Is it a response to his nomination? Is it a response to his likelihood of being nominated and then into the election cycle? Timing is still an issue, but it started early enough in the cycle that it was not just he's the nominee and has a chance of being elected. I need to sabotage him. She was making her statements about this when there was still an ongoing primary and other candidates were still viable, and more than just Bernie Sanders.
And I think I think we have evidence, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there was like a neighbor that had spoken up that she had mentioned it years and years ago as well, right. as something. So
there's,
it's not
there's
just
the
like
mentioning it convenient. And then there's the seeking out the media attention. Those are different things. So
sure.
Ultimately, what I'd like to see in any of these cases is that if there is a accusation, credible accusation, that it be brought to law enforcement does their due diligence and investigates it and does a better job. We have real problems in this country in handling sexual assault as a crime because it's an incredibly hard crime to prosecute. Even in the best of situations, it's not good. You hear the lawyers for the prosecution in this talking about the fact that there are no perfect victims. In almost every single case, the prosecution is very able to point to things that the victims did or didn't do that facilitated the abuse. And then they can point to that and say, well, it wasn't his fault because she egged him on or she allowed it to happen. She could have stopped it.
Her dress was too short.
Yeah. You blame the victim. And there's a lot of people who don't want to go through this process to start with, to relive those experiences, which are very painful, very traumatic. So it is a very hard thing to prosecute successfully. We need to do better with that. And if we can fix that, handling this in the legal system is where it ought to be. And so there ought to be a place for Tara Reid, for Christine Blasey Ford, to go to their police department and say, this happened to me. We need to do something about this. And the people who actually do it, whether Joe Biden did it or not, whether Kavanaugh did it or not, are able to be held accountable before it becomes this circus court of public opinion, because when it gets to that point, it's just a lynch mob.
At this point, even in a perfect world, there isn't any way to figure out what happened, though. We're talking decades ago.
Right.
Right? I mean, Joe Biden is so old that it could be decades ago and he was still a senator.
Yeah, my recollection on the stories that I've read, and this is off the top of my head, so please bear with me, is that this happened in the early 90s. So we're still talking about something that was almost 30 years ago. It's a long time ago this happened. Certainly there's no physical evidence. There's only going to be corroborating evidence from witnesses or people that she's told prior to this. There seems to be some of that going on. There could be contemporaneous notes. There could be the police report. She could have gone down to the police department that week, and that would have been substantial evidence that, hey, she at least was reporting it. Now, that the police department didn't believe her in 92, maybe, but they're like, okay, at least we have that. But we don't have a lot of those kinds of things, and I don't know enough about this situation to talk about what is or is not there, but those are the things what we want to see. But yeah, if given that we don't necessarily have those in our current environment, we are stuck in a situation where, yeah, I can believe her just as much as I can believe Christine Blasey Ford. It doesn't actually matter. And that, I think, is the conclusion that the media makes. They're just leaving out all that messy middle bit that we had with Kavanaugh. We can't prevent Joe Biden from taking the job of president because of this accusation. We already had this big kerfluffle once before, so let's not have all that again. And therefore, we're going to do a disservice to justice and not investigate it in an equal amount here because we know what the outcome is going to be.
Do you think this continues to fester? Will this continue to go? Because it wasn't, I didn't hear much about it until a couple weeks ago, and it has slowly but steadily gained traction. And I think, I don't know what will make it go away. And I understand that it's unlikely anybody in the media is actively trying to suppress this out of like some partisan bias, but it does seem like at some point it's going to be like, yeah, the media's got to cover this, and we've got to start asking Biden the hard questions, and we got to start digging into this more. I don't see what could make this go away, barring Reid coming out and being like, "Ah, sorry, I just made it all up."
It's not going to go away, but I don't necessarily see it becoming a bigger item than it already has. What it's going to do is further reinforce the assumption that Republicans and those on the right have that the media is not doing justice by them, that they are not in their interest, and they'll continue to ignore what the media says. When we look at the situation going on with coronavirus and all the people doing terribly dangerous things that they shouldn't be doing because the president is spouting some hoax solution, no one should be surprised that the rebuttals being published by the New York Times are not being read by these people. The New York Times, for all their benefits, has lost credibility in their minds. Because situations like this are not rare. They are incredibly common. The New York Times makes point after point after point of trying to do the right thing journalistically when it comes to attacking Republicans and saying, okay, that didn't work, and not attacking Democrats.
Yeah. What's in this fight? No dog in this fight. That's the saying.
Don't have dogs in fights, by the way.
That'll get you in trouble,
especially in Virginia.
Yeah. So I have no legally permitted dog in this fight. Is that better? Is that a better qualifier?
I don't know. I don't know if that's better.
Legally permitted dog fight? No, I have. But I have noticed. I seem to have noticed that CNN. Growing up, like, I heard all the liberal media, and you know, I would see some examples of it sometimes in terms of like the national media, but I always thought that CNN did a pretty good job of trying to go down the middle, and I imagine it's got to be really hard when you have someone like Trump just constantly lying every single day and saying the most outrageous stuff and personally attacking pretty much anybody that would challenge him. but it seems like CNN has dropped any kind of pretense of just not being anti-Trump. Like every day, I check CNN most days. I still read it. I'm not one of those people who lives in the bubble and only reads stuff that agrees that I agree with. I seek out all sorts of opinions, but every day it's like CNN will have a video like, look at Don Lemon laughing at Trump's claims, or look at is it Andrew Cuomo? I don't even know which Cuomo it is. One of the Cuomo, whatever the one is, the CNN anchor, like, look at him, like, making fun of this, the White House spokesman or something. And I don't particularly care because I think that it's a complete clown show in the White House. And I'm, in some ways, I'm like, yeah, that's all you can do is laugh at it. But I can only imagine if I was someone even slightly sympathetic to the administration or to Trump to see that every single day and be like, psh, this is just completely not credible, and there's no way I'm going to trust anything coming out of CNN. So I can understand how it's a problem that the polarization and the trying to be objective while also not trying to alienate people.
Yeah, it's not something that has an easy solution because it's not something that has happened quickly. This is a problem that has been building over time, and things that take this long to fall apart have long-term solutions. You know, I work in an environment where people have reputations that have been harmed by past misdeeds, and we're trying to fix that. And you can't fix that by just saying, oh, we're going to do better this time. You have to show people that you're doing better. And you don't get to show people that you're doing better in a day or a week. It takes years. And if at any point during that process of showing people that you're doing better, you goof up and make another mistake, you lose all credibility all over again, and you have to start from square one. So when you have lost trust, as I think that it's fair to say that the news media has for many Americans, it is not something that is won back just by saying, okay, we realize we made a mistake, we're going to do better now. They have to report well, and do it for like the next 20 years before it's going to make a significant impact on this.
Which they're not going
to
do.
Because it doesn't sell newspapers. It's not sensational. It's very hard for them to do because they're in their big city Twitterverse media bubble bias. It is almost impossible for them to do, even if they wanted to, and I don't think that they want to.
Do you think that this will in any substantial way hurt Joe Biden's chances to win the presidential election?
The allegation? Or...
The entire situation surrounding it. Mm. The allegation... I guess... What's beyond the allegation, I guess?
Well, that was my question. If we were seeing something else that I wasn't seeing. I don't...
No, just like whether... Because generally people have been circling the wagons, you know, like... And I say that from, I think, Kirsten Gillibrand, who made her big stink about, you know, women's rights and whatever. She's still supporting Hillary Clinton, who has some experience with, unfaithful spouses. Yesterday or today... endorsed Joe Biden. So everyone from prominent Democratic politicians to, you know, even Alyssa Milano, who made a big stink on Twitter. You're probably not aware, but she's kind of a big deal on Twitter.
I know who she is. There's that.
Yeah, who's the boss?
No, I don't know that.
Joey Tribbiani. No, you don't know. What do you know Alyssa Milano from, if not Who's the Boss?
She's big on Planned Parenthood.
Oh, okay, sure. That would make sense too. But still odd that you don't know her from Who's the Boss. But anyway, she had a big thing about, you know, believe all women, hashtag believe all women, hashtag me too, and made a big hullabaloo about that during the Kavanaugh hearings. And she even got challenged by Rose McGowan. I don't know. I'm probably just picking the wrong random person. But anyways, there are some fights going on in Twitter between the, I don't want to label them radical feminists, but the people who are truly like believe all women and Joe Biden is a rapist because of these accusations, and the...
Let me clarify something real quick here. Joe Biden is not a rapist because of these accusations. Joe Biden is a rapist, and he's been accused of it.
Okay. Do you want to back that up with the...
Tara Reid has accused him of this. We believe all women, therefore he is a rapist. Okay.
You weren't advocating that opinion. You were saying this is the opinion of the other people.
Right. You can't say that... what you said was that he is a rapist because he's been accused. Mm-hmm. He is a rapist. Gotcha. Now we're accusing him of it.
I thought you personally were calling Joe Biden a rapist.
Yeah, I think that's actually probably accurate, though. I mean, my personal opinion is that this is a credible accusation. This is as credible as any other accusation I've heard. And I believe the victims in these cases, unless I have a really strong reason not to. So at the moment, I believe Tara Reid, and I think that Joe Biden probably did this. You know, I'm not going to say 100% confidence, but I'm at 75% confidence.
Interesting. Would you put what percentage would you put in your confidence that Kavanaugh's a rapist?
As 55, 56, something like that.
And be honest with yourself and with me, do you think your own political opinions have anything to do with that?
I try not to, but I have to admit that, yeah, it probably does. I am, because I am more conservative than you are, I am more likely to hear an accusation from a or against a conservative figure and be willing to disbelieve it, and more likely to hear an accusation against a liberal person and be more likely to believe it. So that might account for some of the differences that you're hearing in those percentages. So you split the difference between 55 and 75, and you get a 10-point difference, so it's 65% for both of them. So it's 2/3 chance in both cases, then, that it is that is true.
All right, so I can't remember. Oh, Alyssa Milano, that's where I was at. There are, and again, it's Twitter, so probably pretty meaningless, but there are legitimate fights going on, and Alyssa Milano has basically said, like, you know what, maybe I was wrong to say believe all women, because right now I believe that we should withhold judgment for this Joe Biden mess and wait and see how things work out. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but basically she's somewhat backtracking a little bit, so...
It is also...
Where was I going with
this? It's also totally okay, and not hypocritical at all, to say, I believe Tara Reid, and I still want Joe Biden to be president. It's just, they can't do that, because as soon as they say that, they lose all opportunity to virtue signal on Joe Biden is not this bad person who had these Access Hollywood tape things. He's at least just better on policies, and they need to maintain that Joe Biden is the better person aspect of this, I think.
Well, it'd certainly be hypocritical if they had any kind of history with anything similar on the other side.
Again, this is it's a done deal. Unless he gets hit by a bus or coronavirus, Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee.
Yeah.
Allegations notwithstanding.
I do. Yeah. So I guess I largely agree with you. It's probably not going to make a difference, but it will be interesting to see what happens if another shoe were to drop. If she is telling the truth, it's a little hard to imagine she's the only one. I don't have any particular insight into people who perform sexual assault, but it seems odd that you would do it once in your entire, you know, career and 80 years on this planet. Especially considering the liberties that he takes smelling women's hair and doing other things. And if there were to be even just one more credible accusation, that could be pretty devastating, I would think. But I don't know.
Yeah, I hear exactly what you're saying, and it's extremely plausible that there are other victims, and maybe in an environment where Tara Reid's story was being heard and believed by the media, and therefore getting more exposure, one of those other victims might eventually feel the courage to come forward and start talking about her own experiences as well. But maybe that's one of the benefits that the media is providing to Joe Biden in not covering it or covering it extremely dismissively. They're reaffirming to those other potential victims out there, stay quiet so that this can happen.
Could be. So I had anything else on Tara Reid before we move on?
I don't want to spend a ton of time on that one, because as much as it is a big deal for Joe Biden and his candidacy, and Joe Biden's candidacy is a big deal for the country, I'm not qualified to speak about it. I don't know her personally. I haven't heard her story as actively as I should have if I'm going to talk about it a lot. So I think moving on is probably going to be for the best.
So I had an interesting thought exercise that I ran by some of my friends recently. I want to run by you on the record right now. Right now, we're talking remotely. We're doing a video conference while we're recording this podcast. And pretty much, I would say a large percentage of the nation is practicing social distancing. We're supposed to avoid any gatherings of larger than X number of people, stay mostly within your, avoid unnecessary trips outside of your house, stay mostly within your family unit, whatever, however you want to phrase it. And there are some states who are talking about opening sooner rather than later and whatnot. I'm curious, if this coronavirus, COVID-19 situation, what happens if it continues for the next, let's just say 7 months?
It doesn't even necessarily have to continue for the next 7 months. We could open back up and then all of a sudden it starts getting worse again and we close back in.
Exactly. I guess I should rephrase. Let's say 7 months from now, we're in a not too dissimilar situation than we are now, where there are outbreaks in various places and we're all encouraged to still largely stay at home, largely not be going out and into large crowds. You know what's a large crowd? Is election day, when we all line up shoulder to shoulder to go vote in voting booths and congregate in these large crowds to line up to vote. What happened? I guess it's a really a multi-part or open-ended question, but what happens if we're in the same situation we are now, where we are supposed to be performing social distancing, and because I have no faith in the government has done nothing to encourage absentee voting or remote voting or anything of the like, and we have a presidential election where a lot of, at the same time as social distancing, and we know that voter turnout is very key in terms of how elections are decided.
Absolutely.
And who ends up getting elected. What, and I guess the more focused question is, let's just say in a hypothetical situation that November comes along, presidential election, we're in a similar situation to now, and Donald Trump or the state governments has done nothing to make remote voting easier. And as a result, voter turnout is suppressed, which historically speaking has tended to favor Republican candidates, i.e. a Donald Trump. And let's say Donald Trump wins another election, a re-election, I should say. Do you think that Democrats would accept that as a legitimate victory, or would they consider him to be an even more illegitimate president than he is now? And to the extent of I know there's a spectrum a little
sure.
bit, like some obviously consider him illegitimate now because Russian interference, losing the popular vote, whatever it is, but would it become dangerously so, where we're talking about perhaps an open, not an open revolution, I don't want to get too overly dramatic, but would you see that going?
Okay. So let me start on the calmer side of things first.
That's boring.
It is boring, but I'll build, okay?
Sure, that sounds good. Let's do that. Build the suspense.
So, as I've mentioned on our podcast before, I'm an election officer in Virginia. I'm the chief officer of my precinct, which means that my job every election, primary or general, is to make sure that my precinct operates smoothly. People can come in, can vote, their vote is counted, they vote only if they're registered to vote, etc. I make sure the law is upheld in my precinct.
Make sure there are no racist dogs there.
Yeah, that was a fun one. So in November, we're going to have a general election, and I am assuming that I will be on duty to work that election, because I haven't heard anything to the contrary yet. But at the same time, we definitely have a lot of concerns about that. What I will say is that Virginia law, and this is where I can talk specifically about Virginia because it's my experience, other states are going to be very different, but I imagine that in most cases they're similar. Virginia law is very clear. Elections supersede almost everything. So when I had to call the cops on that dog, all I had to say was, I am working at an election precinct, and I have this problem. And they sent the cop out right away. I was top of the list. The only thing that would have gotten a cop faster is shots fired, right?
What, at a voting location?
Well, sure, that would have been even worse. Yeah. So they came and responded very, very quickly. We take elections in this country very seriously. The state legislature has made that the case. The law enforcement backs that up. Our first responders are very good. almost every election, I hear about some precinct that had to call the fire department, and they're right there as fast as anyone possibly can be. And there's never any problems. The problem comes that even though my precinct is relatively small, we'll have 1,500, 1,600 voters on election day. And you can't have that many voters through a small building in the time period that we have and not have them closed up. We're not going to have huge lines the way we did in 2008, 2012, especially 2012, but we will have lines at various points, and lines means close contact. So will the close contact at the election sites be problematic for the executive orders, assuming there is an executive order similar to the one we have currently in effect in November? Under that assumption, the executive order would say this is not allowed, but the elections get so much leeway that I think we'd be allowed to do it. So people will still be able to come out and vote, even in those kinds of situations. Even if they want to vote and don't want to come out, you mentioned absentee voting. We already have in this country, every state has a process by which people can vote without going to the precinct on the day of the election. Sometimes that means early voting. Sometimes that means mailing in a ballot. And the methods vary significantly from state to state. In Virginia, we have mail-in ballots and we have early access voting in many cases. And the restrictions have been reduced significantly. So there's a lot of opportunity for that to be the case. But we know that not everyone avails themselves of it now. And we also know that not everyone will avail themselves of that, even if in the situation where it becomes clear that that might be a really good idea. People like to wait and make up their mind. They want to wait for that last poll to say, here's who's winning, so they can go vote for the winner. This is what they do.
Yeah. Don't want to waste your vote.
You don't want to waste your vote. You want to make sure you want to vote for the winner. You got to wait for that last poll. So
heavy sarcasm, by the way.
It's disgusting, but this is what people do. I'm allowed to say that, right? I can say that I find the way people vote to be disgusting.
Feel free to call all of our listeners disgusting. You're the villain here, remember?
I'm the villain. That's right.
Yeah.
I'm just the one upholding the law.
Believe me. Actually, I'm a little weird. I'm not very good at impromptu speaking. And so what I will do is during the course of this day, and I think last night is when I initially emailed you saying we had to have an emergency podcast to talk about Justin Amash. Since then, I've been replaying various conversations in my head. And for a long, long time, I had kind of planned out my entire rant against all those idiots out there who basically say, Justin Amash, don't run this year. You're just a Russian tool and you're just going to cause Trump to win. And I was weighing whether I should tell all of our listeners who think that to go to hell or not, because that felt like it was too strong. But at the same time, it kind of accurately represents my feelings on the topic. And
to be clear, you said you're not religious, so you're saying about a metaphysical hell, not the real hell.
Yes, it's a metaphor. And I also had a funny line that I had planned out about how I will, would literally fight you. Not in the sense that, like, literally versus metaphorically, but I will fight you with words and not fists. And so just to give you an idea of how I plan out certain phrases, and when that doesn't work, that's when you get, like, awkward pauses from me where I stop talking, like a Joe Biden, where I'll just start talking about go to Joe 2030 or ranting on about the corn pop and the phonographs. I'm going senile just like he is.
All right, so let's get back to our hypothetical November election.
Let's get away from me.
And your senility, sure. I think that's a good idea.
Aided by three beers.
Three beers here, too. It's threebeer3beer.com.
Four.
You're stepping out ahead of me. He's creeping into the lead, folks.
I'm taking the lead.
That means you got to vote for Paul now.
Yes. Hey, I'm pretty convinced I'll do better than Biden or Trump.
At being president?
Yes.
I agree with that. I'm still not going to vote for you, most likely. I'll vote for Amash. He's actually running.
Okay. That's fair. I would vote for Amash over me as well.
Anyway, in the case where it's not heavily publicized and more people don't take advantage of the opportunities for early voting or mail-in voting, I do agree with you. I think there is a very high chance of suppressed turnout overall. And yes, that does probably give Trump an edge. It also, I think, reinforces my opinion that Amash has no chance in hell.
Okay.
Amash is only going to succeed in this election and have a number of raw number of voters higher than Gary Johnson's if a lot of people turn out. And I don't think his percentage is going to be affected very much either, because yes, the libertarians like you and me who are dedicated hardcore voters will show up as well, but we are still dwarfed in terms of our numbers by the dedicated hardcore voters who vote for the parties.
So let me make sure I'm understanding you correctly. You think that Amash will do better in a high turnout election?
Yes.
Interesting. Why? Can you
let's talk about
that?
This. He's in a high turnout election. He gets more raw numbers for sure. No one sure. debates that. I don't think. I think
we're talking about percentages.
In
though,
percentages,
right?
Your hardcore voters, the ones who will always go to the polls, are the ones who are the most partisan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Libertarians will always be there. The Republicans and the Democrats will always be there. It's your independents and the ones who don't make up their minds as much. And your point is, well, if you're having fewer of them, then they're not going to be splitting their votes between the Republicans and Democrats. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I think that the number of the hardcore partisan libertarians is much, much lower than you're estimating it at. It's not 2% of the population. It's 1% of the population or less. And the rest of the percentages that the Amash or Gary Johnson have pulled in or will pull in come from the people who are splitting their vote and saying, you know what, I don't like either of these candidates, and I'm going to vote for the third party candidate because I want to vote, but I don't want to vote for one of these two clowns.
Interesting. So I don't think that the hardcore libertarians are so much bigger. I think we just have our cause and effect reversed a little bit. I think that in a very an election where emotions are running high and people are like really motivated to either vote for the current president or get the current president out of there, I think that's going to drive up turnout and get people more focused on the two major parties. And in an election where it's more apathetic and it's like, well, both the major party candidates kind of suck, but I don't really care which one is voted in, it'll depress turnout, which will kind of artificially raise the percentage for the third party candidate. So it's, I think it's just a matter of cause and effect. And I understand your point of view. I just think that in this particular election, there's going to be pretty much everyone has an opinion on Trump one way or the other. I feel like more so than most elections, a lot of people have a strong feeling on the incumbent, whether it's pro or against. And I think that's going to drive those people out to vote. And the people who are kind of like, I don't really care, and sitting on the fence that might normally go for the libertarian, they're probably going to say like, you know, I don't care too much, but man, I really don't want that Trump in office. Or man, I really want to MAGA. I don't want to let Biden steal it from him. So, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but yeah.
So continue. Let's come back to another aspect of your question. Assuming that voter turnout is lower, suppressed, not that voters are suppressed, but the turnout is suppressed by events. You know, I don't think that anyone's contemplating the fact that the government through these orders is trying to make turnout lower. Although in Virginia, we had a fun couple of conspiracy theories that you might have seen, but because of the people I spend time with, was seen that our initial executive order saying that the state would basically be in our lockdown situation until June 10th was right up until an election. So the governor was attempting to sway the election by prohibiting campaigning, essentially.
Actually, I think the most enjoyable rumor that I saw, and I don't even know if rumor is the right word for it, it's something less than that, is that high-level government officials realized that there was an asteroid or meteor or something that was absolutely certainly going to impact with Earth and cause an extinction-level event, and there was nothing that could be done about it. And so they made up coronavirus to convince everybody to stay at home and spend some time with their families before it was all over. And that's pretty much it. That's the end of the story. And you know what? as depressing as that kind of sounds initially, I kind of enjoyed that little, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what does the economy matter at that point?
Yeah, it's like, you know what? Like, that's not a bad way to go. Like, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent and feel free to completely reel me back in after this. But I've been trying to enjoy these past couple months as best as I can, because I've read some stuff online about this where I think when we talk to our kids in 10, 20 years about, like, and they're going to ask, you know, they probably won't actually ask us these questions, but imagine they ask us, what was things like during, you know, the coronavirus lockdown? And I'm sure most adults will be like, oh God, it was awful. Like, we had to balance, you know, teaching you stuff, and we couldn't go out to restaurants, and we had to stay, you know, social distancing. We had to stay inside all the time, and we couldn't do anything, and it was really tough. And you think about it from a kid's point of view, this might be like one of the best times of their lives, where if they're in the right age range, like, they're like, oh, but I got to spend so much time at home, and I got to play a lot, and I got to eat all my meals with my family, and I got to spend a lot of time with you guys. And it's entirely possible that, I don't know, it, in some ways, I guess it's the optimist in me trying to make the best of a bad situation, and looking at this, it was like, you know, I get to spend a lot of time with my daughters during some of the best, you know, what, 6 and 7, I guess, is what my daughters are right now. It's a good age, and I'm not going to be upset over the fact that I could spend more time with them during that time.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to look at the best side of it like that.
Definitely there's an upside that I've had as well, spending more time with the kids. But I don't think it's all good for the kids in that regard. Yeah, sure, they get to spend more time with me and they have the family meals, et cetera. But for the older kids, I spent a lot of time talking to my almost 12-year-old, and she's super stressed out. The fact that the virus is going around and is impacting our lives and could take the lives of people she knows and cares about, her grandparents, is something that she is aware of, and it is not something that she's comfortable with, even though, you know, there are good parts to it. There's silver linings to this cloud. It's still a cloud.
Yeah, and that's probably the difference between a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old. I'm sure in some ways my 7-year-old is aware of that fact, but she's not stressed out over
sure.
it, because she's probably at the age where it's like, everyone in her immediate bubble is invincible. Yeah. And yes, bad things are happening to some people out there, but not to her immediate bubble.
Definitely. My 7-year-old is also completely on board with this and is loving the opportunity to sneak snacks all the time and steal her sister's technology and just run. She's the queen of the house and she knows it, right?
Yeah. Now, I have 3 queens of my house. I'm guessing you have 4.
Yeah. Well, the youngest queen of my house is the one who is taking the most liberties with being queen.
Not surprised that the youngest is the problem.
To our election. In the event,
reel me back
in. The event that the turnout is much lower, and again, I don't think that this is a government effort to lower turnout, that people will self-select not to go to the polls because, like, yeah, it's not worth risking my life to vote for someone that I don't like that much, or risking my life to vote against someone I dislike that much. It's, you know, it's not going to make that much of a difference. So people will not turn up, I think. And I think this could be record low turnout for a presidential election. As a result, if we still have credible threats of infection from coronavirus in early November, President Trump has already promised that there will be an election in November. I don't remember the exact wording, so it's possible that maybe it's delayed by 3 weeks. But no matter what the issue is, in November, we're going to have this presidential election. There's been a lot of conspiracy theory talk about Trump using this coronavirus to prevent the next election that would, you know, remove him from office. That's not going to happen. There will be an election. It will be in November. And then that will determine who the next president is. And in the event that there is low turnout, I agree with you. The general consensus is lower turnout supports the Republican candidate. Therefore, Donald Trump is more likely to be elected in that scenario than he is in others. And I think it's 50-50 right now. So if President Trump is elected in that kind of a situation, will that lead to claims that this is illegitimate? Absolutely. There are going to be furious people in the streets. And it's interesting that you immediately started talking about all the ways that they're already talking about him as an illegitimate president. You know, the Russia investigation or the popular vote counts, etc. Those are all factors. And the very first thing that I remember about 2016, second days of November, third day after election, December, were the hashtag of not my president. Right. So even from the very beginning, there has been this complete lack of interest in accepting Donald Trump as the president of the United States by people who are going to be very interested in that all over again. There'll be anger. There'll be foment. You may see protests. You'll see, you know, we saw things kind of like protests with the Women's March and stuff like that. I think you could see that happening on a larger scale. But there's also, if that's happening in November because of the concerns of coronavirus, in January, we're probably still having some concerns about coronavirus as well. So those protests and turnouts may be smaller. Is there a chance for something more serious? Yes. I still see an opportunity for something to go further and there to be pockets of, shall we say, civil disobedience, not my president, taken to a physical level, maybe movements for secession or actual attempts at segregating themselves off from the country. You may actually see some people who have threatened to leave the country actually leave the country for a change. Those are all things that I could see happening this time differently than they have happened in the past, because I do think that the re-election of Trump will be so anathema to some people that they will make life-altering choices that they would not otherwise make.
Yeah, that's kind of the, I guess that was the answer I was hoping for. Like the, it seems completely within the realm of possibility that 7 months from now we're still dealing with coronavirus and have to be taking certain measures to prevent future outbreaks. And it also seems perfectly reasonable that the government won't have taken actions to make it really easy for people to vote remotely and will drag their feet on this.
The government has already made it very easy for people to vote remotely. They're not going to make it easier in the next few months. What they may do is publicize what they have already done to make it easy, and that could increase the number of absentee votes. There are actually very real election concerns about that as well, but that's a different story entirely. You know, but it's going to make people question the legitimacy of this election no matter which way it goes. If coronavirus has an impact like that on this election, if for some reason coronavirus doesn't suppress voter turnout because everyone is doing absentee ballots, and the absentee ballots are going heavily for Biden, and Biden wins the election, you can be absolutely sure that Republicans are going to claim voter fraud. 100%. So regardless of which way this goes, there will be claims of illegitimacy because of this.
Let me ask you this. Do you think it's possible that a similar situation, voter suppression, not by malicious means, but just because of coronavirus, could work the other way? Because of the idea that older voters tend to vote Republican, and older voters also happen to be the ones most at risk of coronavirus, they might actually stay home. And so the voting turnout skews younger and therefore more Democratic. And you see claims of a stolen – well, I guess you just said it, the claims of a stolen election the other way. Do you think that's possible, or do you think now those 70-year-old diehard Republicans are going to vote no matter what?
I think they're probably going to vote no matter what. They'll find the way to do their absentee voting. If they're that old, they might have been absentee voting already.
They've got nothing else to do rather than submit their request for an absentee ballot.
I think the only way that we avoid a claim of – I'm blanking on the term here – what we were just talking about, stolen election. The only way we avoid the claim of a stolen election in 2020's results is if the absentee voting is not significantly higher and Joe Biden wins. Because any way that Trump wins, there'll be claims of illegitimacy. Anyway.
Yeah, probably.
And if Biden wins and there's a substantially increased absentee election, which we would also expect, that will also spur illegitimacy claims. If it happens that Biden wins and there's not a If the increase in absentee voters is 5 or 10% and he wins, I don't think it's going to be that big. But it's 15, 20, 100% increase in turnout for absentee votes, which is very, very likely, if not higher, that will absolutely spur those kinds of complaints. So, yeah, I don't see very many ways where we get through the 2020 election without claims of illegitimacy on the results.
I'll tell you how we do it. We all get together. Kumbaya, and like Justin Amash is president.
Sure. I mean, if Justin Amash wins, then we can certainly avoid claims of illegitimacy, but I personally will have serious concerns about how legitimate that election was at that point. I'll be happy with the results, so I won't be speaking it on the podcast probably, but I'll be wondering, who cooked the books on this one?
I had no idea Putin was that big of a fan of Justin Amash. Okay, so assuming you don't have any further thoughts about how Trump is going to steal the election, I wanted to see if there's any room for not a monetary wager, but just like a friendly competition. Any thoughts on the percentage of popular vote that Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and Justin Amash will receive in the 2020 presidential election? And for point of comparison, we're not talking about absolute numbers. We're talking about percentages. So hopefully turnout is accounted for. In the 2016 election, Donald Trump received 46.09% of the popular vote. Hillary Clinton received 48.18% of the popular vote. Gary Johnson, 3.28%. And then you have Jill Stein with 1.07% and Evan McMullen and so on and so forth, less than 1%. These are from Wikipedia, so it's got to be the best information. What would you, and I'm happy to give you some extra time to think about it if you want. What kind of percentages do you think we see in 2020?
Yeah, I'm running some quick numbers in my head to see if they check out.
Seeing if it adds up to 100. Because it doesn't have to add up to 100, as long as it doesn't add up to more than 100.
That's my biggest thing. Make sure they don't add up to more than 100. I think they probably won't, because I'm just making some... Let me just say, to start with, I don't think that there'll be a seismic shift in terms of the percentages either direction. So Donald Trump coming at 46.09% means he's going to get something close to 46%. I will actually say he's probably going to increase that marginally. I would say that something in the 46 to 48% range is all plausible. I'm going to hold him on the lower end of that because I still think he is a remarkably poor candidate and remarkably unpopular. But I still think he increases from 46.09, and he's going to be able to claim that as a sizable victory as well. And will absolutely do so because that's what he does. I'm going to say he's probably going to pull like 47.2. So he's going to increase that by a full percentage point and a little bit, I'd say. I think that Biden will improve upon Hillary Clinton's performance, because I do think that Biden does not suffer from many of the things that Hillary Clinton suffers from. He is more likable, and he's a man. These things help him. So I think he increases it by close to a full percentage point and comes in at 48.9%-ish, which gets me up to, looks like, 96%, basically. So I got 4% to play around with. Amash does not pull that 4%. I'm going to give him 2.2. I think he substantially underperforms Gary Johnson.
Well, this is pretty disappointing because I didn't go to decimal point precision, but I kind of scribbled down that something around 48% for Donald Trump, 49% for Joe Biden, and 2% for Justin Amash.
Wow, we are really close then.
Yeah, I can even show you. I mean, this is not very interesting for an audio podcast, but I had scribbled it down before you even talked, and I can't even tell if you can see.
I can see that there's mark. Oh, there it is. Down a little. Yeah, this is fantastic audio, guys. Yeah, that's amazing.
So
if you said 48, I said 47.2 for Trump. So you actually are slightly higher on the popular vote than Trump than I was. And we both came in at about 2% for Amash and 49% for Biden. So that's close enough to watch. So really the only difference is that I think that Trump gets slightly less popular vote than you do. And that's probably pretty sad.
I think that What gives me pause is that apparently his approval ratings have gone up during this.
At least temporarily.
Pandemic.
It's probably on its way down again pretty soon because he's continuing to do stupid stuff. But for right now, it's up.
But he was doing even more stupid stuff during the beginning.
I don't think he was. I think the stuff he's doing now is actually stupider, which is remarkable.
I guess it's hard to top the whole, like, let's inject I know that's unfair. Like, technically, he didn't say let's inject Clorox, but it's close enough that I'm not going to give him the benefit of the doubt there. I don't know. I guess worry is the right word, that he's not going to lose a lot of support. If his performance during the past 3 months, in terms of, like, so many things have gone against him, like the stock market, which has always been his, like, oh, look at all the job creation in the stock market, that has gone in the crapper. He has made blatantly stupid suggestions about, like, ultraviolet light and disinfectant inside the body, and it's pretty obvious that there's gonna be zero coronavirus cases in like February or whatever. There's a lot of documented bad handling of this by him, and yet his support has gone up. It doesn't lead me to believe that it's going to go down that much in the upcoming election, so I don't know. I guess we'll be talking about President Biden in 7 months or so, but it'll be interesting to see. That there are a lot of interesting variables that we talked about. I think we agree that Amash is likely to be a non-factor. It obviously pains me to say that, but I'm also a realist, and I realize that he's
weird
not...
stuff happens. But barring really weird stuff, he can count on 2 votes from this podcast. That's 100%.
There you go. He's the president of our hearts.
He's the president of the Rampant Discourse podcast when Travis is not on.
Yeah. And when Travis is on, then maybe he can count on 66%, but that's good enough. Do you have any other closing thoughts? Any other topics you want to talk about before we launch?
No, I think we've gone long enough.
No, we've never gone long enough. People love our political content.
Well, we can do another one then. We'll do another one later.
All right. Check us out at rampantdiscourse.com. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/rampantdiscourse. We have a Discord channel at discord.io/rampantdiscourse. You can follow us on Twitter at rampantdisc. Leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to us. And we hope you enjoy this. Let us know who you're planning on voting for. Maybe we can get a nice little poll going of who our supporters are. And for Paul and Andrew, can't stop the discourse.